This is Audible. Bantam Doubleday Dell Audio presents Difficult Conversations by Douglas Stone, Bruce Patton, and Sheila Heen, read by the authors.
Hello, I'm Bruce Patton.
I'm Sheila Heen.
And I'm Doug Stone. Asking for a raise, ending a relationship, giving a critical performance review, saying no to someone in need, confronting disrespectful or hurtful behavior, disagreeing with the majority in a group, apologizing. At work, at home, and across the backyard fence, difficult conversations are attempted or avoided every day. A difficult conversation is anything you find it hard to talk about. Sexuality, race, gender, politics, and religion come quickly to mind as difficult topics to discuss, and for many of us, they are. But discomfort and awkwardness are not limited to topics on the editorial page. Anytime we feel vulnerable or our self-esteem is implicated, when the issues at stake are important and the outcome uncertain, when we care deeply about what is being discussed or about the people with whom we're discussing it, there is potential for us to experience the conversation as difficult. We all have conversations that we dread and find unpleasant, that we avoid or face up to like bad medicine.
One of the senior engineers at your company, an old friend, has become a liability. Management has picked you to fire him.
You overheard your mother-in-law telling a neighbor that your sons are spoiled and undisciplined. As you prepare to spend the holidays at her house, you're not sure the two of you can get through the week without a confrontation.
The project you are working on took twice as long as you told the client it would. You can't afford not to bill for the extra time, but you dread informing the client.
You want to tell your father how much you love him, but fear that the intimacy might make both of you feel awkward.
You recently learned that several black colleagues on the police force refer to you as an Uncle Tom. You're infuriated, but you aren't sure whether talking about it would accomplish anything.
And, of course, there's the stuff of everyday life. Conversations that feel more ordinary, but cause anxiety nonetheless. Returning merchandise without a receipt. Asking your secretary to do some photocopying. Telling the painters not to smoke in the house. These are the interactions we put off when we can and stumble through when we must. The ones we practice over and over in our head, trying to figure out in advance what to say, and wondering afterwards what we should have said. What makes these situations so hard to face? Whether we raise the issue or try to avoid it, it's our fear of the consequences. Perhaps the neighbor's dog keeps you up at night. Should I talk to them, you wonder? At first, you decide not to. Maybe the barking will stop. Maybe I'll get used to it. But then the dog barks again, and you resolve that tomorrow you're going to talk to the neighbors once and for all. Now you lie awake for a different reason. The thought of getting into a fight with the neighbors about their dog makes you nervous. You want the neighbors to like you. Maybe you're overreacting. Eventually, you come back to thinking it's better to say nothing, and this calms your nerves. But just as you drop off to sleep, that darn dog howls again, and your cycle of indecision starts anew. There doesn't seem to be any choice that will allow you to sleep. Why is it so difficult to decide whether to avoid or confront? Because at some level, we know the truth. If we try to avoid the problem, we'll feel taken advantage of. Our feelings will fester. We'll wonder why we didn't stick up for ourselves. And we'll rob the other person of the opportunity to improve things. But if we confront the problem, things may get even worse. We may be rejected or attacked. We might hurt the other person in ways we didn't intend. And the relationship might suffer. Desperate for a way out of the dilemma, we wonder if it's possible to be so tactful, so overwhelmingly pleasant, that everything ends up fine. Tact is good, but it's not the answer to difficult conversations. Tact won't take away your client's anger over the increased bill. Nor is there a simple diplomatic way to fire your friend or to let your mother-in-law know that she drives you crazy. Delivering a difficult message is like throwing a hand grenade. Coated with sugar, thrown hard or soft, a hand grenade is still going to do damage. and keeping it to yourself is no better. Choosing not to deliver a difficult message is like hanging on to a hand grenade once you've pulled the pin. So we feel stuck. We need advice that is more powerful than be diplomatic or try to stay positive. The problems run deeper than that, and so must the answers.
This program can help. Working at the Harvard Negotiation Project with thousands of people on all kinds of difficult conversations, we have found a way to make these conversations less stressful and more productive. A way to deal creatively with tough problems while treating people with decency and integrity. An approach that is helpful to your peace of mind, whether or not others join in. We are going to help you get out of the hand grenade business altogether by getting you out of the business of delivering and receiving messages. We will show you how to turn the damaging battle of warring messages into the more constructive approach we call a learning conversation. Of course, changing how you deal with difficult conversations takes work, and it can feel threatening. Breaking out of your comfort zone is rarely easy and is never risk-free. It requires you to look hard at yourself, and sometimes to change and grow. But better the ache of muscles growing from an unaccustomed workout than the sting of wounds from an unnecessary fight. The potential rewards are rich. If you follow the steps presented in this program, you will find difficult conversations becoming easier and causing less anxiety. You will be more effective and happier with the results. And as your anxiety goes down and your satisfaction goes up, you will find that you are choosing to engage more in conversations that you should have been having all along. In fact, the people we've worked with who have learned new approaches to dealing with their most challenging conversations find they are less afraid of what others might say. They have a heightened sense of freedom of action in tough situations and more self-confidence and a stronger sense of integrity and self-respect. They also learn that more often than not, dealing constructively with tough topics and awkward situations strengthens a relationship. And that's an opportunity too good to pass up.
If you're skeptical, that's understandable. You may have been struggling with many of these issues for weeks, months, or years. The problems are complex. The people involved are not easy to deal with. And there are limits to how much you can learn about human interactions from an audiobook. We don't know the specifics of your situation, what is at stake for you, or where your particular weaknesses and strengths lie. But we have discovered that, regardless of the context, the things that make difficult conversations difficult, and the errors in thinking and acting that compound these difficulties are the same. It is true that some situations are unlikely to improve regardless of how skilled you become. However, for every case that is truly hopeless, there are 1,000 that appear hopeless, but are not. People often come to us saying, "I want some advice, but I have to warn you, this situation is beyond fixing." And they are wrong. Together, we are able to find some avenue of change that ends up having a significant positive impact on the conversation. Of course, you may not be ready or able to engage or re-engage fully in a difficult situation or relationship. You may be grieving, licking your wounds, or just needing time away. You may be lost in anger or confused about what you want. But even if you are not yet ready to take on an actual conversation, this program can help you sort through your feelings and assist you as you find your way to a healthier place. So what can we suggest that you haven't already thought of? Probably quite a bit. Because the question isn't whether you're looking hard enough for the answer to difficult conversations. It's whether you've been looking in the right places. At heart, the problem isn't in your actions. It's in your thinking. So long as you focus only on what to do differently in difficult conversations, you will fail to break new ground. This program offers plenty of advice on how to conduct a difficult conversation. But first and more importantly, it will help you understand better what you are up against and why it makes sense to shift from a message delivery stance to a learning stance. Only then will you be able to understand and implement the steps of a learning conversation. Still, no matter how good you get, difficult conversations will always challenge you. We know this from experiences in our own lives. We know what it feels like to be deeply afraid of hurting someone or of getting hurt. We know what it means to be consumed by guilt for how our actions have affected others, or for how we have let ourselves down. We know that even with the best of intentions, human relationships can corrode or become tangled. And if we are honest, we also know that we don't always have the best of intentions. We know just how fragile are the heart and the soul. So it is best to keep your goals realistic. Eliminating fear and anxiety is an unrealistic goal. Reducing fear and anxiety and learning how to manage that which remains are more obtainable. Achieving perfect results with no risks will not happen. Getting better results in the face of tolerable odds might. And that, for most of us, is good enough. For if we are fragile, we are also remarkably resilient. Sort out the three conversations. Jack is about to have a difficult conversation. He explains.
Late one afternoon, I got a call from Michael, good friend, occasional client. I'm in a tight spot, he told me. I need a financial brochure laid out, printed by tomorrow afternoon. He said his regular designer was out. He was under a lot of pressure. I was in the middle of another project, but, you know, Michael's a good friend, so I dropped everything, and I worked late into the night on the brochure. Early the next morning, Michael reviewed the mock-up, gave the go-ahead to have it printed. I had the copies on his desk by noon. I was exhausted, but I'd been pretty glad to help him out. Then I got back to my office, and I discovered this voicemail message from Michael.
Well, you really screwed this one up. Look, Jack, I know you were under time pressure on this, but the earnings chart just isn't presented clearly enough, and it's slightly off. It's just a disaster. This is an important client. I assume you'll fix it right away. Give me a call as soon as you get in.
Well, you can imagine how I felt about that message. Yeah, the chart was off, but microscopically. I called Michael right away.
Their conversation went like this.
Hey, Michael, I got your message.
Yeah, look, Jack, this thing has to be done over.
Well, wait a second. I agree it's not perfect, but the chart's clearly labeled. No one's going to misunderstand the...
Come on, Jack, you know as well as I do we can't send this thing out like this.
Well, I think that the...
There's really nothing to argue about here. Look, we all screw up. Just fix it and let's move on.
Why didn't you say something about this when you looked at it this morning?
Jack, I'm not the one who's supposed to be proofreading. I'm under tremendous pressure to get this done and get it done right. Either you're on the team or you're not. I need a yes or a no. Are you going to redo it?
Oh, all right, I'll do it.
Months later, Jack still feels lousy about this conversation, and his relationship with Michael remains strained. He wonders what he could have done differently, and what he should do about it now. This exchange has all the hallmarks of a difficult conversation going off the rails. But before we get to that, let's look at what Jack's conversation can teach us about how difficult conversations work. Surprisingly, despite what appears to be infinite variations, all difficult conversations share a common structure. Understanding that structure is essential to improving how you handle your most challenging conversations. In the conversation between Jack and Michael, their words reveal only the surface of what is really going on. To make the structure of a difficult conversation visible, we need to understand not only what is said, but also what is not said. We need to understand what the people involved are thinking and feeling, but not saying, to each other. In a difficult conversation, the real action is below the surface. Let's take a look, for example, at what Jack was thinking and feeling, but not saying, during his conversation with Michael.
How could Michael leave a message like that? After I drop everything, I break a dinner date with my wife, I stay up all night, that's the thanks I get?
Of course, what Jack actually says is...
Hi, Michael, I got your message.
Yeah, look, Jack, this thing has to be done over.
At this point, what Jack is thinking is...
It's a total overreaction. Not even a CPA would be able to tell the chart is off. At the same time, I'm kind of upset with myself for making this kind of mistake.
But what Jack says to Michael is,
Well, wait a second, Michael. I agree, it's not perfect, but the chart's clearly labeled. No one's going to misunderstand the...
Come on, Jack. You know as well as I do we can't send this thing out like this.
Jack's thinking.
Michael tries to intimidate all his colleagues into getting his way. But he shouldn't try to intimidate me. I'm his friend. I'm doing him a favor. I want to stand up for myself at this point, but I don't want to start a big fight about this thing. I can't afford to lose Michael as a client or as a friend. I feel stuck.
Of course, what Jack says is...
Well, Michael, I think that...
There's really nothing to argue about here. Look, we all screw up. Just fix it and let's move on.
Jack's thinking.
Screw up? This isn't my fault. You approved this thing, remember?
But what Jack says is...
Well, why didn't you say something about this morning when you looked at it?
Jack, I'm not the one who's supposed to be proofreading. I'm under tremendous pressure to get this done and get it done right. You're either on the team or you're not. I need a yes or a no. Are you going to redo it?
All right. I'll do it.
Meanwhile, what Jack's thinking is...
Is that how he sees me, as a proofreader? You know, I'm sick of this whole thing. I'm going to just be bigger than whatever pettiness is driving him, and the best way for me to get out of this situation, I'm just going to be generous and redo the thing.
Meanwhile, there's plenty that Michael is thinking and feeling, but not saying. Michael's wondering whether he should have hired Jack in the first place. He hasn't been all that happy with Jack's work in the past, but he decided to go out on a limb with his partners to give his friend another chance. Michael's now frustrated with Jack and confused about whether hiring Jack was a good decision, either personally or professionally. The first insight, then, is a simple one. There's an awful lot going on between Jack and Michael that is not being spoken. That's typical. In fact, the gap between what you're really thinking and what you're saying is part of what makes a conversation difficult. You're distracted by all that's going on inside. You're uncertain about what's okay to share, and what's better left unsaid. And you know that just saying what you're thinking would probably not make the conversation any easier. In studying hundreds of conversations of every kind, we have discovered that there is a structure to this mess. It turns out that no matter what the subject, our thoughts and feelings fall into the same three categories, or conversations. And in each of these conversations, we make predictable errors that distort our thinking and our feelings, and get us into trouble. Everything problematic that Jack and Michael say, think, and feel falls into one of the three conversations. And everything in your conversations does too. The three conversations are...
The what happened conversation. Most difficult conversations involve disagreement about what has happened or what should happen. Who said what and who did what? Who is right? Who meant what? And who's to blame? Jack and Michael tussle over these issues, both out loud and internally. Does the chart need to be redone? Is Michael trying to intimidate Jack? Who should have caught the error?
The feelings conversation. Every difficult conversation also asks and answers questions about feelings. Are my feelings valid, appropriate? Should I acknowledge or deny them, put them on the table, or check them at the door? What do I do about the other person's feelings? What if they're angry or hurt? Jack's and Michael's thoughts are littered with feelings. For example, Jack says, "This is the thanks I get," and that signals anger. When he says, "I can't afford to lose Michael as a client," that reveals fear. These feelings are not addressed directly in the conversation, but they leak in anyway.
The identity conversation. This is the conversation we each have with ourselves about what this situation means to us. We conduct an internal debate over whether this means we're competent or incompetent, a good person or a bad person, whether we're worthy of love or simply unlovable. What impact might this conversation have on our self-image and self-esteem, on our future and our well-being? Our answer to these questions determine in large part whether we feel balanced during the conversation, or whether we feel off-center and anxious. In the conversation between Jack and Michael, for example, Jack is struggling with the sense that he has acted incompetently, which makes him feel less balanced. And Michael is wondering whether he acted foolishly in hiring Jack. Engaging successfully in a difficult conversation requires learning to operate effectively in each of the three realms. Managing all three simultaneously may seem hard, but it's certainly easier than facing the consequences of engaging in difficult conversations blindly. No matter how skilled we become, there are certain challenges in each of the three conversations that we can't change. We will still run into situations where untangling what happened is more complicated than we initially suspect. We will each have information the other person is unaware of, and raising each other's awareness is not easy. And we will still face emotionally charged situations which feel threatening because they put important aspects of our identity at risk. What we can change is the way we respond to each of these challenges. Typically, instead of exploring what information the other person might have that we don't, we instead assume we know all we need to know to understand and explain things. Instead of working to manage our feelings constructively, we either try to hide them or we let loose in ways that we later regret. Instead of exploring the identity issues that may be deeply at stake for us or for them, we proceed with the conversation as if it says nothing about us, and we never come to grips with what is at the heart of our anxiety. By understanding these errors and the havoc they wreak, we can begin to craft better approaches. Let's explore each conversation in more depth.
The what happened conversation is where we spend much of our time in difficult conversations, as we struggle with our different stories about who's right, who meant what, and who's to blame. On each of these three fronts, truth, intentions, and blame, we make common but crippling assumptions. Straightening out each of these assumptions is essential to improving our ability to handle difficult conversations well. First, there is the truth assumption. As we argue vociferously for our view, we often fail to question one crucial assumption upon which our whole stance in the conversation is built. I am right. You are wrong. This simple assumption causes endless grief. What am I right about? I'm right that you drive too fast. I'm right that the patient should have received more medication after such a painful operation. I am right that the contractor overcharged me. I'm right that I deserve a raise. I am right that the brochure is fine as it is. The number of things I'm right about would fill a book. There's only one hitch. I am not right. How could this be so, you ask? It seems impossible. Surely I must be right sometimes. Well, no. The point is this. Difficult conversations are almost never about getting the facts right. They are about conflicting perceptions, interpretations, and values. They are not about what is true. They are about what is important. Let's come back to Jack and Michael. There's no dispute about whether the graph is accurate or not. They both agree it is not. The dispute is over whether the error is worth worrying about, and if so, how to handle it. These are not questions of right and wrong, but questions of interpretation and judgment. Interpretations and judgments are important to explore. In contrast, the quest to determine who is right and who is wrong is a dead end. In the what happened conversation, moving away from the truth assumption frees us to shift our purpose from proving we are right to understanding the perceptions, interpretations, and values of both sides. It allows us to move away from delivering messages and toward asking questions, exploring how each person makes sense of the world, and to offer our views as perceptions, interpretations, and values, not as the truth. The second argument in the what happened conversation is over intentions, yours and mine. Did you yell at me to hurt my feelings, or merely to emphasize your point? Did you throw my cigarettes out because you're trying to control my behavior, or because you want to help me live up to my commitment to quit? What I think about your intentions will affect how I think about you, and ultimately, how our conversation goes. The error we make in the realm of intentions is simple but profound. We assume we know the intentions of others when we don't. Worse still, when we're unsure about someone's intentions, we too often decide they are bad. The truth is, intentions are invisible. We assume them from other people's behavior. In other words, we invent them. But our invented stories about other people's intentions are accurate much less often than we think. Why? Because people's intentions are complex. Sometimes people act with mixed intentions. Sometimes they act with no intention, or at least none related to us. And sometimes they act on good intentions that nonetheless hurt us. Because others' intentions and their views of ours are so important in difficult conversations, leaping to unfounded assumptions can be a disaster. The third error we make in the What Happened conversation has to do with blame. Most difficult conversations focus significant attention on who's to blame for the mess we're in. In the conflict between Jack and Michael, for example, Jack believes the problem is Michael's fault. The time to declare your hypersensitivity to formatting is before the brochure goes to print, not after. And, of course, Michael believes the problem is Jack's fault. Jack did the layout. Mistakes are his responsibility. But talking about fault is similar to talking about truth. It produces disagreement, denial, and little learning. It evokes fears of punishment and insists on an either-or answer. Nobody wants to be blamed, especially unfairly, so our energy goes into defending ourselves. But in situations that give rise to difficult conversations, it is almost always true that what happened is the result of things both people did or failed to do, and punishment is rarely relevant or appropriate. When competent, sensible people do something stupid, the smartest move is to try to figure out, first, what kept them from seeing it coming, and second, how to prevent the problem from happening again. Talking about blame distracts us from exploring why things went wrong and how we might correct them going forward. Focusing instead on understanding the contribution system allows us to learn about the real causes of the problem and to work on correcting them. The distinction between blame and contribution may seem subtle, but it is a distinction worth working to understand because it will make a significant difference in your ability to handle difficult conversations.
Difficult conversations are not just about what happened, they also involve emotion. This brings us to the second conversation, the feelings conversation. What should we do with our emotions? The question is not whether strong feelings will arise, but how to handle them when they do. In the presence of strong feelings, many of us work hard to stay rational. Getting too deep into feelings is messy, clouds good judgment, and in some contexts, for example, at work, can seem just plain inappropriate. Bringing up feelings can also be scary or uncomfortable, and can make us feel vulnerable. This line of reasoning suggests that we should stay out of the feelings conversation altogether, that Jack is better off not sharing his feelings of anger and hurt, or Michael his sense of disappointment. Better to stick to questions about the brochure. Better to stick to business. Or is it? The problem with this reasoning is that it fails to take account of one simple fact. Difficult conversations do not just involve feelings. They are at their very core about feelings. Engaging in a difficult conversation without talking about feelings is like staging an opera without the music. You'll get the plot, but miss the point. In the conversation between Jack and Michael, for example, Jack never explicitly says that he feels mistreated or underappreciated. Yet months later, Jack can still summon his anger and resentment toward Michael. Consider some of your own difficult conversations. What feelings are involved? Hurt or anger? Disappointment, shame, confusion? Do you feel treated unfairly or without respect? For some of us, even saying, "I love you," or "I'm proud of you," can feel risky. In the short term, engaging in a difficult conversation without talking about feelings may save you time and reduce your anxiety. It may also seem like a way to avoid certain risks, to you, to others, and to the relationship. But the question remains, if feelings are the issue, what have you accomplished if you don't address them? Of course, it doesn't always make sense to discuss feelings. As the saying goes, sometimes you should let sleeping dogs lie. Unfortunately, a lack of skill in discussing feelings may cause you to avoid not only sleeping dogs, but all dogs, even those that won't let you sleep.
Of the three conversations, the identity conversation may be the most subtle and the most challenging. But it offers us significant leverage in managing our anxiety and improving our skills in the other two conversations. The identity conversation looks inward. It's all about who we are and how we see ourselves. How does what happened affect my self-esteem, my self-image, my sense of who I am in the world? What impact will it have on my future? What self-doubts do I harbor? In short, before, during, and after the difficult conversation, the identity conversation is about what I am saying to myself about me. You might think, look, I'm just trying to ask my boss for a raise. Why does my sense of who I am in the world matter here? Or Jack might be thinking, look, this is about the brochure, not about me. In fact, any time a conversation feels difficult, it is in part precisely because it is about you, with a capital Y. Something beyond the apparent substance of the conversation is at stake for you. Asking for a raise? What if you get turned down? In fact, what if your boss gives you good reasons for turning you down? What will that do to your self-image as a competent and respected employee? Ostensibly, the subject is about money, but what's really making you sweat is that your self-image is on the line. Even when you are the one delivering bad news, the identity conversation is in play. Imagine, for example, that you have to turn down an attractive new project proposal from creative. The prospect of telling the people involved makes you anxious, even if you aren't responsible for the decision. In part, it's because you fear how the conversation will make you feel about yourself. You know, I'm not the kind of person who lets people down and crushes enthusiasm. I'm the person people respect for finding a way to do it, not for shutting the door. Your self-image as a person who helps others get things done butts up against the reality that you are going to be saying no. If you're no longer the hero, will people see you as the villain? As you begin to sense the implications of the conversation for your self-image, you may begin to lose your balance. The eager young head of creative, who reminds you so much of yourself at that age, looks disbelieving and betrayed. You suddenly feel confused and your anxiety skyrockets. You wonder whether it really makes sense to drop the idea so early in the process. Before you know it, you stammer out something about the possibility of the project rejection being reconsidered, even though you have absolutely no reason to believe that's likely. In its mildest form, losing our balance may cause us to lose confidence in ourselves, to lose concentration, or to simply forget what we were going to say. In more extreme cases, it can feel earth-shattering. We may feel paralyzed, overcome by panic, stricken with an urge to flee, or even have trouble breathing. Just knowing that the identity conversation is a component of difficult conversations can help. And, as in the other two conversations, you can do much better than mere awareness. While losing your balance sometimes is inevitable, the identity conversation need not cause as much anxiety as it does. Like dealing with feelings, grappling with the identity conversation gets easier with the development of certain skills. Indeed, once you find your footing in the identity conversation, you can turn what is often a source of anxiety into a source of strength. Despite what we sometimes pretend, our initial purpose for having a difficult conversation is often to prove our point, to give them a piece of our mind or to get them to do or be what we want. In other words, it's to deliver a message. Once you understand the challenges inherent in the three conversations and the mistakes we make in each, you're likely to find that your purpose for having a particular conversation begins to shift. You come to appreciate the complexity of the perceptions and intentions involved, the reality of joint contribution to the problem, the role feelings have to play, and what the issues mean for each person's self-esteem and identity. And you find that a message delivery stance no longer makes sense. In fact, you may find that you no longer have a message to deliver, as much as some information to share and some questions to ask. Instead of wanting to persuade and get your way, you want to understand what has happened from the other person's point of view. You want to explain your point of view, share and understand the feelings involved, and work together to figure out a way to manage the problem going forward. In so doing, you make it more likely that the other person will be open to being persuaded, and that you will learn something that significantly changes the way you understand the problem. Changing our stance means inviting the other person into the conversation with us to help us figure things out. If we're going to achieve our purposes, we have lots we need to learn from them, and lots they need to learn from us. We need to have a learning conversation.
Stop arguing about who's right. Explore each other's stories. We began this program with Jack's recollections of his difficult conversation with Michael. Michael's version of the story is different from Jack's. In the past couple of years, I've really gone out of my way to try to help Jack out, and it seems one thing or another has always gone wrong. And instead of assuming that the client is always right, he argues with me. I just don't know how I can keep using him. But what really made me angry was the way Jack was making excuses about the chart instead of just fixing it. He knew it wasn't up to professional standards, and the revenue graphs were the critical part of the financial presentation. One of the hallmarks of the What Happened conversation is that people disagree. Disagreement itself is not a bad thing, nor does it necessarily lead to a difficult conversation. We disagree with people all the time, and often no one cares very much. But at other times, we care a lot. The disagreement seems to be at the heart of what is going wrong between us. And at these times, arguing may seem natural, even reasonable, but it's not helpful. Think about your own difficult conversations in which there are important disagreements over what is really going on or what should be done. In a charitable mood, you may think, well, everyone has their opinion, or there are two sides to every story. But most of us don't really buy that. Deep down, we believe that the problem, put simply, is them. Because they're selfish. My girlfriend won't go to a couples counselor with me. She says it's a waste of money. I say it's important to me, but she doesn't care. Or because they're naive. My daughter's got these big ideas about going to New York and making it in the theater. She just doesn't understand what she's up against. Or because they're controlling. We always do everything my boss's way. It drives me crazy because he acts like his ideas are better than anyone else's, even when he doesn't know what he's talking about. Or we believe the problem is them because they're irrational. My great-aunt Bertha sleeps on this sagging old mattress. She's got terrible back problems, but no matter what I say, she refuses to let me buy her a new mattress. Everyone in the family tells me, "Rory, Aunt Bertha is just crazy. You can't reason with her." I guess it's true. If this is what we're thinking, then it's not surprising that we end up arguing. Rory, for example, cares about her Aunt Bertha. She wants to help. So Rory does what we all do. If the other person is stubborn, we assert harder in an attempt to break through whatever is keeping them from seeing what is sensible. If you would just try a new mattress, you'd see how much more comfortable it is. If the other person is naive, we try to educate them about how life really is. And if they are being selfish or manipulative, we may try to be forthright and call them on it. We persist in the hope that what we say will eventually make a difference. But instead, our persistence leads to arguments. And these arguments lead nowhere. We each feel unheard or poorly treated. We're frustrated. Not only because the other person is being so unreasonable, but also because we feel powerless to do anything about it. And the constant arguing isn't doing the relationship any good. Yet, we're not sure what to do instead. We can't just pretend that it doesn't matter, or that it's all the same to us. It does matter. It's not all the same to us. That's why we feel so strongly about it in the first place. But if arguing leads us nowhere, what else can we do? The first thing we should do is hear from Aunt Bertha. Aunt Bertha would be the first to agree that her mattress is indeed old and battered.
It's the one I shared with my husband for 40 years, and it makes me feel safe. There are so many other changes in my life. It's nice to have a little haven that stays the same.
Keeping it also provides Bertha with a sense of control over her life. When she complains, it's not because she wants answers. It's because she likes the connection she feels when she keeps people current on her daily comings and goings. About Rory, Aunt Bertha has this to say.
I love her, but Rory can be a difficult person. She doesn't listen or care much about what other people think. And when I tell her that, she gets very angry and unpleasant.
Rory, it seems, thinks the problem is Aunt Bertha. Aunt Bertha thinks the problem is Rory. This raises an interesting question. Why is it always the other person who is naive or selfish or irrational or controlling? Why is it that we never think we are the problem? If you were having a difficult conversation and someone asks why you disagree, how come you never say, "Because what I'm saying makes absolutely no sense"? We don't see ourselves as the problem because, in fact, we aren't. What we are saying does make sense. What's often hard to see is that what the other person is saying also makes sense. Like Rory and Aunt Bertha, we each have different stories about what is going on in the world. In Rory's story, Rory's thoughts and actions are perfectly sensible. In Aunt Bertha's story, Aunt Bertha's thoughts and actions are equally sensible. But Rory is not just a character in her own story. She is also a visiting character in Aunt Bertha's story. And in Aunt Bertha's story, what Rory says seems pushy and insensitive. In Rory's story, what Aunt Bertha says sounds irrational. In the normal course of things, we don't notice the ways in which our story of the world is different from the other person's. But difficult conversations arise at precisely those points where important parts of our stories collide. We assume the collision is because of how the other person is. That person assumes it's because of how we are. But really, the collision is a result of our stories simply being different, with neither of us realizing it. It's as if Princess Leia were trying to talk to Huck Finn. No wonder we end up arguing. But arguing is not only a result of our failure to see that we and the other person are in different stories. It is also part of the cause. Arguing inhibits our ability to learn how the other person sees the world. When we argue, we tend to trade conclusions, the bottom line of what we think. Get a new mattress versus stop trying to control me. But neither conclusion makes sense in the other person's story, so we each dismiss the other's argument. Rather than helping us understand our different views, arguing results in a battle of messages. Rather than drawing us together, arguing pulls us apart. Arguing creates another problem in difficult conversations, too. It inhibits change. Telling someone to change makes it less rather than more likely that they will. This is because people almost never change without first feeling understood. Consider Trevor's conversation with Karen. Trevor is the financial administrator for the state-funded Department of Social Services. Karen is a social worker with the department. Trevor explains.
I can't get Karen to turn in her paperwork on time. I've told her over and over again that she's missing the deadlines, but it doesn't help. When I bring it up, she gets annoyed.
Of course, we know there's another side to this story. Unfortunately, Trevor doesn't know what it is. Trevor is telling Karen what she is supposed to do, but has not yet engaged her in a two-way conversation about the issue. When Trevor shifts his purposes from trying to change Karen's behavior, arguing why being late is wrong, to trying first to understand Karen and then to be understood by her, the situation improves dramatically.
Karen described how overwhelmed and overworked she is. She puts in all this energy into her clients who are very needy. She was feeling like I didn't appreciate that, which actually I really didn't. And I explained to her how I have to go through all kinds of extra work when she submits her paperwork late. And I explained the extra work to her in detail, and she felt bad about that, and it was clear that she just hadn't thought about it from my perspective. She promised to put a higher priority on getting her work in on time, and so far she really has.
Finally, each has learned something, and the stage for meaningful change is set. To get anywhere in a disagreement, we need to understand the other person's story well enough to see how their conclusions make sense within it. And we need to help them understand the story in which our conclusions make sense. Understanding each other's stories from the inside won't necessarily solve the problem, but it's an essential first step. As we move away from arguing and toward trying to understand the other person's story, it helps to know why people have different stories in the first place. Our stories don't come out of nowhere. They're built in often unconscious but systematic ways. First, we take in information. We experience the world, sights, sounds, and feelings. Second, we interpret what we see, hear, and feel. We give it all meaning. Finally, we draw conclusions about what's happening. And at each step, there is an opportunity for different people's stories to diverge. There are two reasons we have different information about the world. First, as each of us proceeds through life and through any difficult situation, the information available to us is overwhelming. We simply can't take in all of the sights, sounds, facts, and feelings involved in even a single encounter. Inevitably, we end up noticing some things and ignoring others. And what we each choose to notice and ignore will be different. Second, we each have access to different information. To begin with, we notice different things. Doug took his 4-year-old nephew Andrew to watch a homecoming parade. Sitting on his uncle's shoulders, Andrew shouted with delight as football players, cheerleaders, and the school band rolled by on lavish floats. Afterwards, Andrew exclaimed, "That was the best truck parade I've ever seen." Each float, it seems, was pulled by a truck. Andrew, truck-obsessed as he was, saw nothing else. His Uncle Doug, truck-indifferent, hadn't noticed a single truck. In a sense, Andrew and his uncle watched completely different parades. Of course, neither Doug nor Andrew walked away from the parade thinking, "I enjoyed my particular perspective on the parade based on the information I paid attention to." Each of them walked away thinking, "I enjoyed the parade." Each assumes that what he paid attention to was what was significant about the experience. Each assumes he has the facts. In a more serious setting, Randy and Daniel, co-workers on an assembly line, experience the same dynamic. They've had a number of tense conversations about racial issues. Randy, who is white, believes that the company they work for has a generally good record on minority recruitment and promotion. He notices that of the 7 people on his assembly team, 2 are African Americans and 1 is Latino, and that the head of the union is Latino. He has also learned that his supervisor is originally from the Philippines. Randy believes in the merits of a diverse workplace and has noticed approvingly that several people of color have recently been promoted. Daniel, who is Korean-American, has a different view. He has been on the receiving end of unusual questions about his qualifications. He has experienced several racial slurs from co-workers and 1 from a foreman. These vivid experiences are prominent in his mind. He also knows of several minority co-workers who were overlooked for promotion, and notices that a disproportionate number of the top executives at the company are white. And Daniel has listened repeatedly to executives who talk as if the only 2 racial categories that mattered were white and African American. While Randy and Daniel have some information that is shared, they have quite a bit of information that's not. Yet each assumes that the facts are plain and his view is that of reality. In an important sense, it's as if Randy and Daniel work at different companies. Often we go through an entire conversation, or indeed an entire relationship, without ever realizing that each of us is paying attention to different things, that our views are based on different information. In addition to choosing different information, we each have access to different information. For example, others have access to information about themselves that we don't. They know the constraints they are under. We don't. They know their hopes, dreams, and fears. We don't. We act as if we've got access to all the important information there is to know about them, but we don't. Their internal experience is far more complex than we imagine. Let's return to the example of Jack and Michael. When Michael describes what happened, he doesn't mention anything about Jack staying up all night. He might not know that Jack stayed up all night, and even if he does, his knowledge would be quite limited compared to what Jack knows about it. Jack was there. Jack knows what he felt like as he struggled to stay awake. He knows how uncomfortable it was when the heat was turned off at midnight. He knows how angry his wife was that they had to cancel their dinner together. Jack knows about the anxiety he felt putting aside other important work to do Michael's project. Jack also knows how happy he felt to be doing a favor for a friend. And there is plenty that Jack is not aware of. Jack didn't know that Michael's client blew up just that morning over the choice of photograph in another brochure Michael had prepared. Jack doesn't know that the revenue figures are a particularly hot topic because of questions about some of the client's recent business decisions. Jack doesn't know that Michael's graphic designer has taken an unscheduled personal leave in the midst of their busiest season, affecting not just this project, but others as well. Jack doesn't know that Michael has been dissatisfied with some of Jack's work in the past. And Jack doesn't know how happy Michael felt to be doing a favor for a friend. Of course, in advance, we don't know what we don't know. But rather than assuming we already know everything we need to, we should assume that there is important information we don't have access to. The odds are good that it will be true. A second reason we tell different stories about the world is that even when we have the same information, we interpret it differently. We give it different meaning. I see the cup as half empty. You see it as a metaphor for the fragility of humankind. I'm thirsty. You're a poet. Two especially important factors in how we interpret what we see are, one, our past experiences, and two, the implicit rules we've learned about how things should and should not be done. The past gives meaning to the present. Often it is only in the context of someone's past experience that we can understand why what they are saying or doing makes any kind of sense. To celebrate the end of a long project, Bonnie and her co-workers scraped together the money to treat their supervisor, Caroline, to dinner at a nice restaurant. Throughout the meal, Caroline did little but complain. "Everything is overpriced. How can they get away with this? And you've got to be kidding. $5 for dessert?" Bonnie went home embarrassed and frustrated, thinking, "We knew she was cheap, but this is ridiculous. We paid so she wouldn't have to worry about the money, and still she complained about the cost. She ruined the evening." Though the story in Bonnie's head was that Caroline was simply a cheapskate or wet blanket, Bonnie eventually decided to ask Caroline why she had had such a strong reaction to the expense of eating out. Upon reflection, Caroline explained,
"I suppose it has to do with growing up during the Depression. I can still hear my mother's voice from when I was little, getting ready to go off to school in the morning. 'Carrie, there's a nickel on the counter for your lunch,' she'd call. She was so proud to be able to buy my lunch every day. Of course, once I got to be 8 or 9, a nickel wasn't enough to buy lunch anymore. But I never had the heart to tell her."
Years later, even a moderately priced meal can feel like an extravagance to Caroline when filtered through the images and feelings of this experience. Every strong view we have is profoundly influenced by our past experiences. Often we aren't even aware of how these experiences affect our interpretation of the world. We simply believe that this is the way things are. Our past experiences often develop into rules by which we live our lives, a second factor in how we interpret what we see. Whether we are aware of them or not, we all follow such rules. They tell us how the world works, how people should act, or how things are supposed to be. And they have a significant influence on the story we tell about what is happening between us in a difficult conversation. We get into trouble when our rules collide. Ollie and Thelma, for example, are stuck in a tangle of conflicting rules. As sales representatives, they spend a lot of time together on the road. One evening, they agreed to meet at 7 o'clock the next morning in the hotel lobby to finish preparing a presentation. Thelma, as usual, arrived at 7 o'clock sharp. Ollie showed up at 7:10. This was not the first time Ollie had arrived late, and Thelma was so frustrated that she had trouble focusing for the first 20 minutes of their meeting. Ollie was frustrated that Thelma was frustrated. It helps to clarify the implicit rules that each is unconsciously applying. Thelma's rule is, it is unprofessional and inconsiderate to be late. Ollie's rule is, it is unprofessional to obsess about small things so much that you can't focus on what's important. Because Thelma and Ollie both interpret the situation through the lens of their own implicit rule, they each see the other person as acting inappropriately. Our implicit rules often take the form of things people should or shouldn't do. You should spend money on education, but not on clothes. You should never criticize a colleague in front of others. You should never leave the toilet seat up, squeeze the toothpaste in the middle, or let the kids watch more than 2 hours of TV. The list is endless. There's nothing wrong with having these rules. In fact, we need them to order our lives. But when you find yourself in conflict, it helps to make your rules explicit and to encourage the other person to do the same. This greatly reduces the chance that you will be caught in an accidental duel of conflicting rules. When we think about why we each tell our own stories about the world, there's no getting around the fact that our conclusions are partisan, that they often reflect our self-interest. We look for information to support our view and give that information the most favorable interpretation. Then we feel even more certain that our view is right. Professor Howard Rafa of the Harvard Business School demonstrated this phenomenon when he gave teams of people a set of facts about a company. He told some of the teams they would be negotiating to buy the company and others that they would be selling the company. He then asked each team to value the company as objectively as possible, not with the price at which they would offer to buy or sell, but what they believed it was actually worth. Rafa found that the sellers, in their heart of hearts, on average, believe the company to be worth about 30% more than the independently assessed fair market value. Buyers, in turn, valued it at 30% less. Each team developed a self-serving perception without realizing they were doing so. They focused more on things that were consistent with what they wanted to believe and tended to ignore, explain away, and soon forget those that weren't. This tendency to develop unconsciously biased perceptions is very human and can be dangerous. It calls for a big dose of humility about the rightness of our story, especially when we have something important at stake. There's only one way to come to understand the other person's story, and that's by being curious. Instead of asking yourself, "How can they think that?" ask yourself, "I wonder what information they have that I don't." Instead of asking, "How can they be so irrational?" ask, "How might they see the world such that their view makes sense?" One way to shift your stance from the easy certainty of feeling that you've thought about this from every possible angle is to get curious about what you don't know about yourself. This may sound odd. After all, you're with yourself all the time. Wouldn't you be pretty familiar with your own perspective? In a word, no. The process by which we construct our stories about the world often happens so fast and so automatically that we're not even aware of all that influences our views. For example, when we saw what Jack was really thinking and feeling during his conversation with Michael, there was nothing about the heat being turned off or about his wife's anger at canceling their dinner plans. Even Jack wasn't fully aware of all the information behind his reactions. And what implicit rules are important to him? He thinks to himself, "I can't believe the way Michael treated me," but he is unaware that this is based on an implicit rule of how people should treat each other. Jack's rule is something like, "You should always show appreciation to others, no matter what." Many of us agree with this rule, but it is not a truth, just a rule. Michael's rule might be, "Good friends can get angry with each other and not take it personally." The point isn't whose rule is better. The point is that they are different. But Jack won't know that they're different unless he first considers what rules underlie his own story about what happened. It can be awfully hard to stay curious about another person's story when you have your own story to tell, especially if you're thinking that only one story can really be right. After all, your story is so different from theirs and makes so much sense to you. Part of the stress of staying curious can be relieved by adopting what we call the "and" stance. We usually assume that we must either accept or reject the other person's story, and that if we accept theirs, we must abandon our own. But who's right between Michael and Jack, or Bonnie and her boss, Caroline? Who's right between a person who likes to sleep with the window open and another who prefers the window closed? The answer is that the question makes no sense. Don't choose between the stories. Embrace both. That's the and stance. The suggestion to embrace both stories can sound like double talk. It can be heard as, pretend both of your stories are right. But in fact, it suggests something quite different. Don't pretend anything. Don't worry about accepting or rejecting the other person's story. First, work to understand it,